Okay, thanks very much, David, and thanks to the organizers, particularly Nick, for inviting me to give this talk, which was asked to be around the changes to the guidelines for the treatment of gonorrhea and their role, I guess, in gonorrhea control. I have a couple of disclosures here, so just as you can read them, basically work with GSK, GARDP, up until earlier this year, and some work with Speedex for the MG assay in our clinic. So in terms of antibiotic prescribing, I think we all understand the importance of why we have guidelines. They're critical for us to use in our healthcare settings, particularly when we're using antibiotics. Antibiotic resistance is a major problem facing the world. STIs is just one component of the problem, but I mean, it goes across the whole of medicine, and it is something that we really are going to struggle with in the next couple of decades. These guidelines, they guide the prescribers really on the antibiotic treatment, which is the best antibiotic to use, what's the correct dosage, when and how should it be taken, and how long should it be taken for. And when you're dealing with antimicrobial resistance, you know the guideline may be different in different parts of the country, as you can see for gonorrhea in Australia. So in some settings, there are local guidelines to guide our decision-making. I think we'll talk about that a little bit later when we see the ASHA guidelines. Increasingly, clinicians are being asked to choose now from numerous and sometimes differing and contradictory guidelines. And we're starting to see this now with the divergence between what's happening in Australia, for example, the BASH guidelines in the UK. The CDC are also moving to dropping azithromycin and putting in a higher dose of ceftriaxone. It's just an example. And if you adopt guidelines where there's a questionable validity, you can end up with ineffective interventions. And of course, that leads to inefficient use of scarce resources and harm to all our patients, which is the last thing we want to see happening. Now, in the context of Australia, there are two sets of guidelines which are important for us in sexual health. The first is the ETG, therapeutic guidelines, which is a leading source of accurate and independent practical treatment advice for clinical conditions. As you can see here from the website, it discusses the importance of explicit instructions and assists practitioners in decision-making. And under the term antibiotics, it took a little while for me personally, I don't use these very often, to find out where the STIs were, because I thought they'd be under something else on the list, like sexual and reproductive health, but they're not. They're sitting under antibiotics. So there's a tip for you. But you can find the approach for gonorrhea, and there's also something about M. genitalium for those of interest as well. And then there's the Australian STI management guidelines for use in primary care, which again influence a lot of our clinical work in the sexual health services. And these are overseen by ASHA, the Australian Sexual Health Alliance, or probably Australasian, I should say, Sexual Health Alliance, formed through ASHAM. And Chris Bourne, who's here, is part of this group. It facilitates a lot of collaborations to support the sexual health workforce in relation to policy education and resources. And it's important, whenever you have guideline changes, you need education. It's not just a question of putting guidelines up. You need to do the training and so forth to make sure the workforce knows what's going on. So this is a very important part of ASHA and ASHAM's work. It's also importantly recognised by the Australian College of General Practitioners. I'm going to mention a bit about CDNA, the Communicable Disease Network of Australia as well, because this links into why the group did its work. Established in 1989 as the Communicable Diseases Control Network, it's an initiative from NHMRC and the Australian Health Minister's Advisory Council. And there are a number of objectives you can see there. Just to pull out a few. So if you look at, for example, the second one is about policy and strategy and advice on prevention and control of communicable diseases, including gonorrhea. If you look at the fourth one, it's about investigation and control of multi-jurisdictional outbreaks of communicable disease, which is what happened when we were dealing with the importation of at least one of these two XDR strains that have been discussed in the previous talks. And one was in Western Australia, and then we had the other one over in Queensland. And also working with national and international partners. So a lot of work has to go on between health ministries as well, working with the other countries if there's been an importation of a resistant strain, providing advice or also offering help if needed to try and improve surveillance and so forth in the other country. So really what triggered the group to get together was the quite worrying appearance of these extensively drug-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea isolates. The first one came through from the UK. It was a strain imported from Thailand, and then subsequently, very soon afterwards, we got these two in Australia. The one in Western Australia was linked to the Asia-Pacific region, and the other one, no one quite knows where it came from, but it pitched up in Queensland. This rang a lot of alarm bells, and the CDNA were quick to act on this, and there were a number of things that they had to do, and one of them was look at the treatment and the guidelines. So Christine Selvey was asked to put a group together, and that's where we started to do our deliberations. So this CDNA working group, it's important people understand we're not a guideline committee. We were a working group to make recommendations that would be looked at by the two committees. That's the ETG and the ASHA committee. And the working group lists the people that are there, including Chris, also Tim Reed was there when he was at Melbourne, David Spears and Marcus, Monica and Lewis Marshall and David Patterson. And we were supported through the Ministry of Health with the Secretariat. And our real remit was, I think, to provide guidance around the XDR management, because there is no guideline on what to do when the first lines are not working very well. But in doing so, when we got together, we realized we also need to consider if our first line treatment needs any tweaking at all. So that actually involved quite a lot of discussions, and I would say probably more heated discussions than the XDR component. So just to say a few things about gonorrhea treatments in Australia. So ceftriaxone remains the cornerstone of our therapy. Azithromycin was added in 2014 to theoretically, because it's important to understand, it's theoretically reduced the rate of emergence and transmission of ceftriaxone-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea. When you're dealing with AMR, you're right on the forefront of the wave, and you don't really have the evidence to back you up. So a lot of it does sit around expert opinion and discussions. It was always assumed there'd be in vitro synergy between ceftriaxone and azithromycin. Very little evidence to support that, but there is a little bit. And there's one study here from Lindley Barbie et al., published in 2013, which did show a reduced repeat positive throat gonorrhea test that when azithromycin and ceftriaxone were co-administered. There was a 7% repeat rate compared to ceftriaxone alone when it was a 9%. But it's not like major evidence, but it's some evidence to support. It's in the right direction. Now, the other thing that was observed in Australia was that there was a substantial decline in the number of gonococcal strains with elevated MICs to ceftriaxone. Even though they were still sensitive, the MICs became more susceptible, if you like. They dropped and became smaller numbers during the dual therapy era. But this has been achieved at the cost of increasing azithromycin resistance. And as David pointed out, we're not quite sure what's driving that resistance. It may not be the fact it's been given as dual therapy in gonorrhea, it may be extensive use for other conditions in the country, including chlamydia. So the update of it all was that we decided within Australian setting to increase the azithromycin in the throat to 2 grams, and we left everything else as it was. There was a lot of debate about getting rid of azithromycin altogether, so we did have those discussions. There were some members of the group who felt quite strongly that we should drop it and it should be just ceftriaxone raised to 1 gram. But in the end, the consensus gradually moved towards the increasing, doing something at the throat, because this is where we were really worried about where we're going to have problems. Everything else changed the same. And if you see at the bottom here is a good example of our regional, the remote rural areas where we can get away with the oral treatments as highlighted by previous speaker. So what was the rationale for going to 2 grams for oropharyngeal infection? Well, first of all, the reason it was put in the first place was to be a dual antibiotic approach to try and create this pharmacological barrier to the development of further resistance, much in the way that we would use multiple drugs to prevent TB resistance, I guess. That's the underlying theory. The cure rates we know are better with 2 grams than 1 gram. And dose is very important when the strain's MIC is near the clinical breakpoint. So that's the level, the MIC level of the organism, at which point you no longer are going to see effective cure. So it's a microbiological level. Sometimes in patients, they'll tell you in the lab it's a low-level resistant strain, but it still responds to the drug in clinical practice. But you just need to be aware there's a clinical breakpoint, and most of the strains now in Australia are sitting just a little bit below that. They're not a long way down like they used to be. They're coming up close to that clinical breakpoint. If you increase the dose of the azithromycin, you're going to raise the level of the bar. It's a little bit harder for those strains to tip over and start failing. So the reason we're worried about the throat is that there have been reports of treatment failure in the oropharynx due to strains of Neisseria gonorrhoeae, which have got sensitive ceftriaxone MICs. So the labs reported them as sensitive or susceptible, but they've still failed. There are few of them, but they do occur. So that we know is because the level of the drugs in the oropharynx is not as good as the level of ceftriaxone in, for example, the rectum or the urethra or the cervix. So we have a lower efficacy of most agents, in fact, the oropharyngeal site, and some drugs are really bad, like spectinomycin and gentamicin at that particular site, the throat. So I guess that was the rationale for why we changed. There are a few practice points that's important people understand. So if the patient's already been treated for confirmed or presumptive anogenital gonorrhea with the 1 gram azithromycin and ceftriaxone dual therapy regimen, and then they subsequently get a NAT test back for their positive throat sample, and they do not need another treatment with 2 grams. We're happy to let the 1 gram run, and the assumption that nearly all of those will have been treated. 2 grams, there's a lot of argument about whether it does increase the gastrointestinal side effects and how severe that is. Generally, if you eat before you take azithromycin, most people find it relatively tolerable. You can provide an antiemetic if people are perceived to be at risk of vomiting. It is important to appreciate that the very early trials, the first trial from Hunter Hansford et al. Had a lot of side effects, but subsequent trials didn't have anywhere near as many with high dose azithromycin. And azithromycin 2 grams has been used in a lot of syphilis trials now, and the syphilis trials didn't have real problems with the adherence. So we think that there's often a lot of scaremongering, if you like, around the side effects, and it's probably not as bad, but we obviously got to monitor it. Azithromycin, this is important practical issues available on private prescription in Australia, but there's no PBS restricted benefit for gonorrhea treatment, so that can create some challenges. And people who have difficulty accessing private treatment can be referred to publicly funded sexual health services where they're available for support and receive the drugs. So these were the guidelines that we had. So these are for susceptible strains, by which I mean the MIC for ceftriaxone is less than 0.125 milligrams per liter. So we're kind of moving into an era now where we actually need to be aware what the MIC values are. This has implications for laboratories. They may need to start reporting the MIC. And the question then becomes, is the infection susceptible to azithromycin or not? If it is, it's fully susceptible. It goes down to get the 1 gram. Zithro plus the 500 milligrams of ceftriaxone, unless it's a throat infection, in which case you give the 2 grams. If there's low-level resistance, by which the MIC cutoff's usually around 2 milligrams per liter for azithromycin, so if it's sitting like 1, 2, 4 milligrams per liter, we would be happy as well to still use azithromycin at the higher dose to get over that by raising the barrier. But for the high-level resistance, and here we're talking about greater than 2.56 milligrams per litre, so it's very highly resistant, we see there's no point in giving azithromycin, so just recommending ceftriaxone, but at a higher dose now, at 1 gram. For the strains, which there are very few of these, but when they pop in, these are your XDR, your multiple drug-resistant strains, where the ceftriaxone MOC is reported at 0.125 milligrams per litre or greater, Again, we got to ask the question, what's the susceptibility to azithromycin? If it's fully susceptible, we would recommend still using azithromycin as a dual therapy, but at a higher dose now at 2 grams for every case, whether it be anogenital or throat, along with IM spectinomycin or IM gentamicin or IM/IV ertapenem. And that's a 3-day treatment. If there's low-level resistance or high-level resistance to azithromycin, the recommendation of the group was just to go with the drugs on their own, spectinomycin, gentamicin, or ertapenem, but be fully understanding that both gentamicin and spectinomycin perform very badly, and I'm talking about 80% efficacy now, in the oropharynx. And so the decision was made in that particular setting, which will be very rare, that we would want to see something added to protect and make sure that we did eradicate that infection. So the rifampicin 600 milligrams twice a day for 2 days would be recommended. This is just kind of almost at the end of my talk now, but I just wanted just to highlight some of the stuff that Cameron's been going through. Because there's going to be other ways of managing people if we can get a precision mechanism in place that's really working. So you've got these ciprofloxacin susceptibility assays now that can, and resistance plus GC assay from Speedex has just been cleared this year in February by TGA that can now tell us whether it's resistant or sensitive to the Keftrax, to the ciprofloxacin, and whether we can go ahead and use that oral agent, which of course is extremely good for pharyngeal gonorrhea. And we'd be very comfortable with giving that as a single treatment. David's group there, you've heard about the S91 locus being a very important locus and highly predictive of ciprofloxacin susceptibility if the wild type is detected. There are some caveats. Ciprofloxacin can't be used in pregnant women. It's not useful in those countries with high pre-existing levels of QRNG, that's quinolone-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea. So any patient that's picked up, for example, using India as an example, where the rates of QRNG are probably in excess of 95%, you're not going to want to treat somebody who's come back from India with the quinolone. You expect quinolone resistance to rise the more we start using it again, the more resistance we're going to start seeing, because this is what happens with antibiotics. And that will impact potentially on some of the new drugs coming along, particularly gepotidacin, because we know it doesn't perform as well for isolates where the MIC90 is high. So where there's resistance, high-level resistance to ciprofloxacin, you get less effect with the gepotidacin. So it will impact on our next generation of drugs as well. So we need to be a little bit wary of that moving forward. But nonetheless, I think it will give us some breathing space and hopefully some time for new drugs to come along the way. And who knows, you know, some of the more success with the meningococcal vaccines, we might be able to reduce the amount of gonorrhea that down to a reasonable level. So I think the conclusions from me, the take-home messages are antibiotic resistance is worsening all over the world for all sorts of bacterial agents. The threats of hard-to-treat or untreatable Neisseria gonorrhea in the near future are real, and we do need to be careful. These things can take off very quickly and spread, particularly if you've got a network where there's not much condom use and lots of sexual partner exchange. Getting these sort of strains into that sort of network could be really bad news. Reducing the incidence of gonorrhea is probably the most important thing we should do now while we've still got active drugs. I think that's a really important message. So we've really got to do as much as we can to get these infections down while we can still do that. Clinical practice guidelines and regulatory oversight are key in antimicrobial stewardship and to also increase the longevity of the drugs we've got. The approaches that Cameron's talked about with molecular susceptibility-guided therapeutic approaches will enable us to recycle some of the older antibiotics we've given up on. And regional surveillance systems are critical to inform the guidelines. And as you saw from some of the other slides and the colored map pictures, you basically haven't got the knowledge in most of the countries around Australia. So we've got very weak surveillance in our region, and so therefore we have to rely on the strong surveillance systems that are here at the present time. Thank you.